They're coming for you.
I know.
I love your name tag.
And we are live. Yes, we do need to get you one of those, even though we were virtual for this Comic-Con.
Hello, I sent everybody. Those out. I made those.
Oh, no. I meant for your name tag in Get Vocal says, that's no moon. It's a...
Oh, nice. Thank you.
Hello, everybody. So my name is Josh Gilliland, and so it's Star Wars Saturday, and with me is Thomas Harper and Nari Ely, and we're going to talk about General Veers today. Yes, everyone's favorite Imperial professional soldier who has a fair amount of screen time when you actually think about it and lives. So,
and is competent.
Yeah, there's a lot to be said for General Veers. So for those who aren't familiar with General Veers, Thomas, could you tell us who General Veers is?
So if you've seen Empire Strikes Back, you know him, even if you don't know his name. General Maximilian Veers is a ground force commander in the Imperial Army. In Empire Strikes Back, he's tasked with commanding all Imperial ground forces at the Battle of Hoth under the flag of Blizzard Force. And they successfully rout the rebels, destroy the rebel shield generator so that Imperial forces can land, seize the base, yada, yada, yada. Interestingly, in the expanded materials in the comics and whatnot, he's actually placed in charge of the overall operation to find the rebel base, which is called Project Swarm. So you see all those probe droids go out at the beginning of Empire Strikes Back. That's one arm of this larger, much, much larger Imperial effort where thousands of probe droids are sent out. The previous Imperial commander failed and met a quick end, courtesy of Darth Vader, and General Veers was promoted into that spot and succeeds. So,
yes, and we see lots of Imperial leaders in Star Wars kill civilians left and right. And, you know, granted, there's also a hostile work environment because they bump off admirals like there's no tomorrow. So it's like that's kind of bad for morale. Let's talk about Veers and whether or not he could be prosecuted and convicted of war crimes, which means we first have to understand what's a war crime. And Nari, could you illuminate for us what can be a war crime?
Sure. So it can be a complicated question because what is a crime is written down only in a few places for war crimes. What we're talking about is the realm of international law and law of war. Some of that is in written form. So we'd be talking about the Geneva Convention, the Treaty on the Use of Chemical Weapons, things like that. But there's a whole body of it that is not written down, but is generally still considered to be law in the law of war, which is just sort of the collected norms that have been in place, you know, for some amount of time. Those things are subject to change. They're not really written down anywhere except in treatises where people try to catalog them. So it can get kind of... there are some general rules that, you know, we can look at from the Geneva Convention, which deal with the treatment of prisoners of war. And then there's also the law of war things with, you know, how much civilian casualties are you allowed to have in any given operation before it becomes a war crime?
And it's interesting, right? Because the traditional like crimes that you would potentially commit by doing acts of, you know, acts that you do in war are suspended. Really, they don't exist in the same sense in on a battlefield. If a soldier is in a war zone and kills the enemy, that's not considered murder, you know, in the correct circumstances, which is an odd thing to think. I mean, you know, if you kill somebody else, you know, on a normal day, that's murder and you're going to get prosecuted. Not so on the battlefield, but there are boundaries and limits to that. And that's exactly what Nari is talking about. Things like there are certain things that are out of bounds and unlawful to target, something like civilians, she mentioned. You can't intentionally target a civilian. That's you know, the law of war and the entire body that makes it up. Place boundaries like that to try to rein in the destruction. I mean, you know, war, it's almost an oxymoron that there would be, you know, laws and rules to war. But with each chaotic and destructive conflict, society and the nations involved kind of come together and try to rein that destructiveness in. And so that body of law that Nari explained has really evolved over entire millennia to where it is now. And if we look back at this, if we're like legal geeks 30-30, and we're looking back on what the law of war was as we sit here right now, it's probably going to keep evolving as that process continues.
Just to highlight some things that are no longer part of our current law of war, we do not have announcers who announce the winner of battles and then it's over. And we do not have a process whereby two champions can fight and then that's it. Nobody else dies.
No, but we should. General Veers and Han Solo have a showdown on Hoth. And
oh yeah, that sounds like a good plan, definitely.
Just a good old-fashioned slugfest. Yeah, that would be entertaining, to say the least. So let's get into some of Veers' war record. So we know is from Wikipedia that his war homeworld was Dinon. Thomas, you're the champion at Star Wars trivia. Is that pronounced correctly?
Close enough.
So we do have two noted two battles that are referenced. One is a Zoris, and again, you know, Harrison Ford's comment about George Lucas could write it, but that doesn't mean someone can pronounce it. And that race rose up against the Empire in 3 ABY, and the note that Veers demonstrated courage and cunning in battle, which led to his promotion to general. And then Kolrun 3, which was an uprising against the Empire from 19 BBY to 3 ABY, which would have been earlier in his career. And he was assigned to Death Star 1, but it was destroyed before he got there. So he's known for being loyal to Vader, and that made him a favored figure amongst the Imperial hierarchy because he got stuff done. Now, the really fun Imperial handbook, which I got at Disneyland a couple years ago, highlights Imperial equipment, tactics, and there is a war record from Veers. And they also have him as the author of the equipment and ground weapons that the stormtroopers, Imperial forces could use. And so like, that's just kind of neat because it's supposed to be in his voice. Thomas, can you walk us through the pacification of Selene? Because that sounds kind of familiar to Iraq in some instances.
Yeah, so Selene, which in this handbook, there is a Selene that's mentioned with one L that's deeply involved in this political battle between Tarkin and Krennic. So if you're familiar with that conflict from, oh, I'm trying to think of the book. It's the Rogue One prequel. This is a different Selene with two L's. But Veers is in charge of rooting out a rebel cell there. This is actually during the Galactic Civil War, post-destruction of the Death Star, I think. And it's an intense ground battle. The rebels are dug in. They're dug in amongst a civilian population, or at least civilian buildings. And Veers goes in hard with AT-ATs, AT-STs, eventually decides he's got an AT-AT that's mechanically damaged. It's dragging a back left leg. And he decides to just make it go stationary and open fire as a raised gun platform, which is like the most amazing thought that I can think of for a Star Wars ground battle. But they open fire on the buildings that the rebels are in. destroy the buildings, send them fleeing, and then chase after and destroy the fleeing rebels and bring peace and justice and security to Saline, as is the Imperial way. But it's a story, you know, his point in the journal entry is this combined arms approach where he's using AT-STs and TIE fighters as close air support to sort of augment the AT-ATs, something that the Empire did very little of at Hoth, but that's another podcast.
Yes. Yeah, and Nari, do you want to add anything from the pacification of According to Veers?
Factually, you mean? Because I think Tom covered that pretty well. I suppose the only thing that I would add, I can't recall if you covered this specifically, but he did announce the opportunity to surrender.
Yeah, it's a weird phrase in there because he says he uses a loudspeaker to call a surrender, and then it flushes the rebels out, and then he starts shooting at them, which is an interesting tactic.
But
do we want to go through these events chronologically and discuss which ones might be war crimes?
Yeah,
but wanted to lay the foundation first.
Sure.
And I wanted to add to Saline that there's building-to-building fighting, rebels in the buildings launching mortar or missile-type attacks or RPGs.
The space from building of those.
things we would consider in this category. So again, it's street-to-street fighting. After the rebels are routed, they try making a getaway in boats because it's a port city, and TIE fighters then take care of them. Now, why don't we toss in Hoth, and then let's get to the legal analysis. And Nari, would you like to highlight what Hoth was? And if not, we can go to the Trivia King for...
Sorry.
Yeah, so Hoth, as we all know very dearly from our hundreds of times collectively watching Empire Strikes Back, the rebels have established a hidden base. Hoth is this desolate world. There's no other life forms, unless you want to count Tauntauns and Wampas there. That's true. It sounds like in the upcoming, from a certain point of view, Tauntauns and Wampas may be sentient because there's a couple stories involving them. But the Imperials have to land ground forces outside the boundaries of the this massive planetary or massive shield that the rebels have. And it falls to General Veers to lead that ground force in underneath the shield, destroy the shield generator, destroy the rebels as they're defending their retreat, and allow Vader to land and bring Imperial forces directly down on the base. And as we see in the movie, he has, 5 AT-ATs that he brings, a number of AT-ST walkers, and it's a pretty bloody battle. The rebels are effectively mounting a tactical retreat during it, but they throw a lot of forces at it. And Veers fights through to the bitter end, right? You know, probably my favorite scene, it's a little macabre, but he's got the shield generator targeted, and before he fires on the shield generator, there's one rebel that's running, and he stops and shoots that little rebel. It's just like a little infantryman, and he dies, and then he shoots the shield generator. So he's nothing if not thorough in his smashing of Echo Base. And that's the last that we see of General Veers, is Echo Base falls and Vader makes his landing and entrance into the base.
Yeah, he's not on screen ever again, but he does work his way into the hearts of millions of fans who just gravitated to this character.
And I hope Veers is watching this. I don't know if he's out there, but I hope.
Hope springs eternal. Well, let's get into war crime analysis, because we have multiple battles now that we've seen from his career. So if he was apprehended after Jakku or beforehand and put on trial, could he be convicted of anything? And, you know, the law has to be factual, because you can't just say you're an imperial, therefore you're a bad guy, therefore you're a war criminal, because he's the professional soldier. So what does this mean from that point of view? And, you know, so we could talk about waging wars of aggression, murder, killing hostages, wanton destructions of cities, things, military destruction that's not deemed necessary, or crimes against humanity. So let's talk about what we know. And so why don't we start with what we just discussed, and that was Hoth. You know, would there be any issues with Hoth and being able to convict him for any war crimes? And Nari, you have your thinking face on.
So, I think for the part you mentioned that this is a war of aggression, and you know, the law of war that I'm most familiar with is the law that applies once war has begun. But there is a separate body of law that dictates basically when wars are considered justified, in the sense that they don't violate international law, which is weird, right? You would think that the international law would be no war ever, never. but there are better or worse reasons to go for war to go to war. I believe that. So there was an international court ruling in 2018 saying that you can prosecute the leaders who go on a war of aggression, but I think General Veers doesn't qualify for that, does he?
I wouldn't think so. I don't think he's high enough. Certainly the Imperials have a joint chiefs, and he's not one of them, at least not that we know of. Certainly not as of Hoth. There's a little bit of a vacuum of leadership. So after Jedi, so maybe he got a quick promotion, but yeah, I don't think from what we've seen of him, he would be on the upper echelon.
Yeah. I can't see that he had anything to do with the original decision to go to war. Right.
Uh-oh. Yeah. I don't think he would have been in that decision. I don't even know. I think he's it's fair to say he's probably a 4-star general at Hoth, but not, you know, he's probably a little lower ranking when the war broke out years earlier.
What do you think, Josh?
Yeah, it goes to the issue of what is the nature of the conflict, the Galactic Civil War. And I think that's fact by fact. If we're dealing with pacification of planets that are in rebellion versus taking on the rebellion, those are two distinct issues.
So oh, for the issue, absolutely. Good call, Josh.
So going after the rebellion, which is declared war on the Empire, has destroyed, you know, Scarif, destroyed Death Star 1, you know, following the comics, a lot of other hit and run top type operations and building a fleet. So there's definitely armed conflict between those two groups. And I would think that would be a legitimate conflict between those two forces, because the rebels do represent multiple systems and multiple races, but there are a uniform bunch for the most part, even though it still might be kind of scattershot on the uniforming, but there's still an organization. Or maybe it's, you know, you have senators who are like, yeah, we're not on board with this anymore because the Empire dissolved the Senate and, like, we're not cool with that. So, again, you get the Mon Mothmas and others who are leading this rebellion.
And it matters who wins, too. It shouldn't, yeah. But there's such a thing as victor's justice. And the rebels show that. I mean, we know, at least from canon material, that they do declare certain Imperials war criminals and pursue justice against those folks. And I think that matters in this context, because that's going to be the narrative, right? That this was a, you know, that they were justified in fighting in self-defense or whatever you want to call it. And that's going to be the bend that it takes. And who, you know, who's going to be there to argue for the empire in a meaningful way. And that gets changed if, you know, the empire is in charge and suddenly I think from their point of view, the rebels are unprivileged combatants that don't have the legal right to wage war. You know, they're not a they might be a confederacy of different systems, but you know, I think similar to folks like ISIS and the Taliban in the real world, you know, we, the United States or NATO or whatever fighting body is on the other side, looks at that and we say, you know, you're not a privileged enemy combatant, the same as, say, like a Germany in World War II.
Yeah, and I think there are some parallels there, including that, you know, in, not until much later when they've had some serious successes do they even officially occupy territory. They have hidden bases. Yeah. Right, Alderaan is blown up. Supposedly, I'm gonna put scare quotes here, but because the rebel base might have been there, like, but they didn't actually officially have Alderaan as like a rebellion or a rebel planet per se.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Yerst doesn't give the order to blow up Alderaan. So again,
oh, for sure. I was just using that as an example.
Yeah, but like I want to carry that forward. Like, we can't graft Tarkin given the order to blow up Alderaan on Veers, mm-hmm. just because he was going to be stationed there and it got blown up before he got there doesn't mean that that responsibility flows to him because he's still alive. So.
And I think that's an important distinction, because I can imagine a scenario in which the survivors of Alderaan and certain members of the New Republic would have a lasting bitter taste in their mouth over, and that's really an understatement, but a lasting desire for vengeance and justice against the Empire for that. And if you can't get the Emperor, you can't get Darth Vader, you can't get Grand Moff Tarkin or Krennic or Galen Erso or really anybody that had a direct role in that Death Star project, I could see a scenario, and we go back to Victor's justice, where there's an attempt to hold somebody accountable for it. I mean, there was some amount of outcry and a little bit of pushback with some of the Nuremberg trials. And there was a question about responsibility for certain German officers with the atrocities that they were tried for. In most cases, ultimately not successful. But I think there's a very real chance that there would have at least been a push to hold somebody accountable. And you know, if you've got an officer like a General Veers with the rank and record that he has, he might be an attractive target if he's the highest ranking person that they're able to capture.
And I see that as well, because you don't just have Alderaan, because Alderaan sweeps away Jeddah, but you still have Jeddah. And that was the battle cry at Scarif for Jeddah, remember Jeddah. So I could see them like tacking that on as the subset to the charges, because people are still very upset about that high of a death toll. But is he the right guy to go after? Which, again, interesting question, and I do want to do a mock trial about this at some point, because this is a beautiful question for lawyers to nerd out and understand how these rules work and who's responsible for those command decisions. If all the commanders are dead, you know, what do you do at that point? But it also raises other fundamental questions of, you have to hold somebody accountable for their own actions. Mm-hmm. And if this was, you know, somebody who was a professional soldier doing their thing, that's different. Now, I mean, again, we could do the World War II comparison to, you know, the Blitzkrieg on London, you know, for the Battle of Britain. bombing civilian targets, and Germany was the first to do so, puts them as the role of the aggressor, and they're hitting civilians, and that's a war of aggression. I don't think Veers does that in his record that's either on Wikipedia, which then gets into a closer analysis of what do we know about these battles in order to examine, did he do anything that would be considered a violation of the laws of war?
Star Wars is very good at black and whites, and it's my favorite go-to when I give training like this or training on the law of war, rules of engagement to actual soldiers, because it provides, I mean, it's not necessarily a nuanced view in a lot of cases, but it provides sort of clear-cut examples. And Hoth, to me, is a clean battle from Veer's standpoint. It's not one that I think in any way he violated the law of war that he could stand to be charged for anything for. When you wipe away, and I'm intentionally ignoring any question of like the combatant status of the rebels or anything like that. We're treating them as combatants. They are out there firing weapons at the Empire. This is a just fight. The killing of the rebel soldiers, pilots in Rogue Squadron, that sort of thing, that's war. That's battle. Those losses are chalked up. That's not murder. That's, one enemy killing another enemy, right? So there's nothing wrong there. I think the closest or the most interesting thing you get is when the rebels call retreat, you have a number of them fleeing back toward the rebel base to get on the transports to flee. And Veers is clearly still firing on them as they're running away. And so there's a question of whether that is proper. And I think it is in this point that it's a sort of an ugly aspect of war, but there's a difference between, and the term under the law of war is, it's escaping me now. But they have to be out of the fight. That's the translation from the Latin that's escaping me right now. The enemy soldier has to be out of the fight in some way so that they are non-targetable, so that they are not a proper target. That could be a surrender. So if a rebel soldier stands there and waves the white flag.
Throws down their weapons, for example, that kind of thing.
Yep, throws down their weapons. If they're injured, or is the combat. There it is.
Yes, I had seen that.
Sometimes it takes a minute if it's not Star Wars trivia, it takes a minute for all the cylinders to fire. Similarly, if somebody's injured and they're out of combat, if they're injured in a way that they're unable to fight back and whatnot, they're also out of the fight. You can't target them, that sort of thing. That's not what we see from the rebel soldiers. They're still carrying their weapons. In some cases, they're still firing on the Imperials to cover their retreat, that sort of thing. They're all still in the fight. And so that's, I think, the closest that Veers gets. But, regardless of how tasteless it may seem, those are enemy soldiers that are ripe for the picking. They just happen to be easier targets than when they were embedded in the trenches and in their vehicles and whatnot.
Yeah, I totally agree with you, Tom. I think that there's a difference between being a ruthless or cold-blooded military officer, which we might not find admirable qualities, but that does not make one a war criminal. It's generally accepted in the law of war that a retreating enemy is still a dangerous enemy. The U.S. Law of War manual takes that view. Enemy combatants remain liable to attack when retreating. Retreating is not the same as surrender. Retreating forces remain dangerous as the enemy force may recover to counterattack, consolidate a new defensive position, or assist the war effort in other ways. Now, I agree with you that, I think we can accept that the rebels are considered to be proper combatants. I agree that there are some issues with consistency in their uniform, but they at least have consistent insignia, right? That kind of stuff. It would be a little different, not necessarily in this legalistic sense, if they weren't a uniformed force, but they might the Empire might have a different strategy if it wasn't a uniform force, because then you might be instead, you know, considering more of peacekeeping goals. So, you know, not assigning a ruthless commander who is going to shoot every running person might be good for keeping the peace.
And that's a really good point, because, and I go back to this black and white thing, there is no need for the sort of distinction and the effort to distinguish between civilian and military targets, like there is in that ambush scene in Rogue One and on Jedha, where the Imperials are having to make rapid decisions on who to fire on. Is that guy, you know, a partisan under Saw Gerrera? Is it just a normal civilian that's trying to flee? Hoth is just this barren world, and the only people there are rebel soldiers. And certainly the only people that are out on that battlefield seem to be rebel soldiers, not any moisture farmers or snow farmers or anything like that.
I don't think the Imperials kill any Wampas or Tauntauns or whatever, so I think, you know,
That gets to the deleted scene where they were supposed when 3PO like pulls a warning sign off a door, and like that's where Wampas were hanging out.
That's right.
And that would have been a rough day for those.
There's a good if you've seen Saving Private Ryan, when we're talking retreating soldiers and whatnot, there's a good example in that toward the end of the D-Day scene at the beginning of what is not okay. And there's a moment where several German soldiers come out of one of the bunkers and their hands are up. They've thrown down their weapons, and one of the American soldiers shoots them and then makes a joke out of it. That's not okay. They're out of the fight. They're not going to regroup, rearm, that sort of thing. So that's not okay. Nor is the scene where they're going to execute that last German machine gunner at the radar installation that they attack. So if you want a good juxtaposition, go take a look back at Saving Private Ryan.
And I would add, there's also a big difference between sinking lifeboats or shooting pilots who bailed out in a parachute, like out of the fight. And that tends to make people mad when you go, you strife the lifeboat. Now, I mean, like this would be like shooting escape pods, because we haven't seen anyone actually bail out in Star Wars with a parachute, but we do see escape pods.
If only Jack Porkins had listened to the advice he was given to eject, we might have like a parachute. I'm trying to picture how you eject from an X-wing over the Death Star. Open that hatch and capture him.
And it's not a there's no, it's not a full helmet.
I know. What does so it the, do?
Don't dig too deep.
So it's the pressure suit could make sense for surviving in the vacuum.
Yeah, like a TIE fighter.
But not the face. Yeah, it's like the TIE fighter completely makes sense. Like, yeah, they could go pick him up. The X-Wing pilot, not so much. There's or Y-Wing or A-Wing or B-Wing. I mean, it makes sense at lower altitude. And maybe Rebels with one of the battles on Lothal, that's failed with a Syndulla, and they get captured. But I don't remember seeing them bail out with parachutes. That said, I do want to draw a distinction between another general before talking about Saline, and that's from Rogue One, General Draven, ordered the targeted killing of Galen Erso. That's very different than what Veers does in taking on uniformed soldiers, because ordering the assassination of someone is a very different tactic, which we can get into another time, but I just want to highlight rebels aren't always clean hands, especially in Rogue One. But let's talk about Saline with street to street fighting and rebels and civilian buildings. And there is a note that the city had been evacuated, so it was just rebels left in the city.
Again, Star Wars making it nice for us. I will say, so generally the law of war, when you talk about targeting specifically, certain people can be, you know, legitimate military targets, but also you have to look at what you're shooting and the objects that you're targeting as well. And so places can be proper or improper targets as well. And the general rule, and then I'll shut up for a minute, but the general rule is that civilian property, if it's purely civilian property, an apartment building or a business or something like that, you can't intentionally target it. It's off limits. Same with things like churches, you know, a graveyard, that sort of thing. Cultural property is off limits. And so that's the baseline rule, that civilian property gets the same protection and the same treatment as a normal civilian does.
Yeah, I would add, you guys are probably too young for this, but you might have seen it in history books. But, you know, I was in high school when Gulf War I happened. And when we did our bombing campaign and really did a number on Baghdad, and it was, you know, war in the evening news. Well, the Iraqis were trying to, you know, have Baghdad Bob go out and explain, you know, the evil Americans. And in one of the factories that we targeted and blew up, they decided to put up a sign that's in English saying baby milk factory to make it look like that we had bombed a baby milk factory. Yeah, and literally the world did a collective eye roll with like, no, no, we know you don't have signs in English saying baby milk factory, and this is you thinking that we're all really dumb. But yeah, we don't have baby milk factory on one of these buildings where the rebels are hanging out. And there's also the difference between we decided to build the weapons in the school playground. It's like, well, you just made the school a target by doing that. And you're using children as human shields. So go bomb the factory at nighttime so you don't bomb it when the kids are at school, which is, again, World War II type scenarios.
Yeah.
So applying that to Saline, Nari, what's your read on this battle?
So I honestly don't see, so I'm more than prepared for somebody to take issue with this. I don't really see anything in here that stands out to me as that was a war crime. Now, is it established that the city is in fact completely evacuated of civilians, just out of curiosity?
I thought that was one of the sentences.
I think it said all of downtown Saline have been designated a free fire zone. So I suppose that means that most people at least have evacuated, right? And people who haven't have willfully disobeyed an evacuation order.
You mean the rebels?
Yeah.
You know, but even if there are still some civilians in these buildings, and this, you know, may win me no fans, but let's just instead pretend I'm being the defense lawyer for the Imperials here, which is, that, you know, the law of war does not actually say you can't kill any civilians or damage any civilian property. It says you cannot intentionally target it. So that's the first. So, you know, and this is, of course, Veers' retelling. So maybe there will be some rebel soldiers who survived who tell a different tale. but in his account, at least, he is not intentionally targeting buildings just because he thinks the city has rebel sympathies. He's targeting positions from which rebels are firing. And, you know, to the extent that there are some civilian casualties or certainly civilian property damage, what we're looking at there is something called proportionality instead. And proportionality is, you know, kind of fuzzy. There's no clear, you know, table and chart that you can point to say this was proportional and this wasn't. But it basically means that the amount of civilian collateral damage, be it property or lives, can't be, you know, outsized compared to the value of the military target. Now, none of that applies if you're intentionally targeting civilians instead, because now you have a civilian target. But that's what proportionality means. And that doesn't mean, for example, I think it's a common misunderstanding. It doesn't mean that if they're firing at you with rifles from the buildings, you can't fire back with an AT-AT cannon. that's not what proportionality means. Now, in this case, just under Veers's telling, it seems to be pretty proportional. So even in the case where there are rebels firing from buildings, at least the details that he provides suggest that he doesn't flatten the building, right? Just because they're getting shot from the building. He said that he fired and blew out the top stories from which they were firing, and then survivors actually fled out the ground floor. Query whether there were any civilians in there, not just rebels, but this is why uniforms are important. But, you know, for our purposes, I'm assuming that those are, in fact, rebels. Tom, Josh, do you have any other thoughts?
Yeah, I think so you hit on a lot of key points there. I think the analysis to me is the same, whether maybe with a slight degree of difference, whether the town has been completely evacuated. Obviously, that makes it a little cleaner, or if there are stragglers left. And I look at this, if there are some civilians left in the downtown area of Saline, I look at it like Mosul or Raqqa in the Iraq Syria campaign against ISIS, these big urban battles where large efforts were made to clear out or evacuate as many civilians as possible. You have an enemy that's deeply dug into an urban area. It's impossible to know with certainty that you've gotten all the civilians out. And in fact, it's probable that there are still civilians there. But as Josh mentioned, the enemy has moved into these buildings. Normally, civilian building could be an apartment building, could be a business, whatever. So they're using it for military purpose, for cover and concealment. Move between buildings, that sort of thing, and you know, stage their battle against the empire. So those buildings are stripped of their protection. They become legitimate military targets to the extent that the rebels are using them. And there's, you know, it's going to depend on Veers as the ground force commander. And as Nari points out, proportionality analysis is something that he has to do. It's going to fall to him, using all of the available information that he has, to make a call as the ground force commander on what amount of force is necessary. It's clear from that short story that they're taking a lot of fire from these buildings. The rebels are well armed, they're well equipped, and they're well trained. They have weaponry that can destroy Imperial armor. And so, you know, I think all of those factors go into Veer's decision making to open fire on some of these buildings. And clearly he feels comfortable enough that civilians aren't present in high numbers to open fire on these buildings. And Nari's exactly right. It's an ugly truth about war, but civilian casualties are expected to a certain extent. Large efforts, tremendous efforts are made in real life to minimize these casualties. So, you know, you don't have somebody out there like Grand Moff Tarkin who's just obliterating entire planets or anything like that. But care, you know, some care seems to have been given here to make sure that this is a battle against the rebels and not against Salient. I won't put it past the Empire at all to try to, stomp the boot heel down on a civilian population to bring them into line to subjugate a planet. That's just not what that seems like here. And so, wiping out the entire, city from orbit with a Star Destroyer is one thing. I think that's on the far end of the proportionality scale that Nari mentioned, and probably not okay. But doing the sort of thing that General Veers is doing, I liken that to being in an Abrams tank in downtown Baghdad and taking fire. You're not prohibited outright from opening fire with that main gun on a building just because it's a civilian building. Where it can go wrong, and it sometimes does in the real world, is if you make mistakes or if you look at the available information and just ignore stuff. So if Veers is just clearing his AT-ATs to fire on anything, and you know, maybe they're doing that because of the free fire zone, that might cause problems after the fact. You know, maybe somebody comes up and says, hey, you leveled you know, an entire baby milk factory and now the poor children of Salient have no milk. Maybe that's a little bit different, but he seems to be intentionally targeting the rebels. In the real world, there was a tragedy in northern Afghanistan in Kunduz province. There's a hospital, it was like made headlines in 2014, 2015, I think, where it was a Doctors Without Borders hospital. U.S. forces believed that the Taliban had occupied this hospital and were actively firing on it. There was a special forces team that was under fire. Turns out the coordinates got relayed wrong. And so while there were Taliban forces in a building, they were not in this hospital. And so a U.S. gunship opened fire, turned out to be a hospital. It was a bad shoot. Lots of innocent folks, unfortunately, were destroyed. And it was a very bad look. And everybody had to take a big step back and see what went wrong there. That's where things can go wrong. Mistakes can happen. I think the law of war recognizes, and this would be in Veer's advantage, that, you know, mistakes can happen and a commander has to, you know, can't be held as omnipotent. So Veer's knows what he knows. He's responsible for that information, but not this omniscient sense of that he should know about every single person in every single building on that planet.
Yeah. You first, Josh.
So I just zoomed in on the handwriting that's in this book because
there is a handwritten note,
and it's from Mon Mothma, and her
rebuttal.
It's a deplorable overreaction. The Governing Council of Saline had protested the seizure of its citizens by the ISB secret police. The Imperial Governor branded them traitors. This was the result.
Oops.
Yeah. So that I don't know how much that changes this, because if they were firing upon the AT-ATs, like, what, you know, is it? Well, that just gets a little bit more complicated, because is it the military governor who did this then? And what about the factor that they actually fired upon the Imperials? Now, granted, this is from Veer's point of view, so naturally he does make it sound good to him. But that is a nice wrench in this analysis.
Yeah, well, you throw a lot into question there. You know, Nari mentioned that this was a free fire zone. Was that how was that declared? Yeah. And, you know, I go back to my comment that it matters what the commander knows. And do you have witnesses that can, because Veers is going to say, hey, I was sent in, we were fired upon, these were rebel forces, uniformed rebel forces, or, you know, insurgents that were attempting to destroy my forces. He's going to need some, or the rebels are going to need some pushback to testify that, hey, look, these AT-ATs landed and just started blasting things, and we're just trying to defend ourselves. What would you have done in this situation? So that gets sticky fast.
Yeah. Who fired first?
This is one of the ways that war crimes are a little similar to regular crimes, in the sense that there is not just a bad act, there is a bad intent. And so it does matter what a person knows when they undertake an action. Do they know that it was going to cause severe collateral damage? Or when it comes to just targeting civilians intentionally. So this would be like, you know, the hospital that they mistakenly believed was full of, let's say, rebels instead of Taliban. You know, did they know that it was, or even suspect perhaps, that this wasn't wasn't the right target, that it might be full of civilians. If they genuinely believed, though, that it was in fact a rebel stronghold, then they would not intentionally targeting civilians. And just in case anyone's curious, this is one of the ones that's written down. The UN in Article 8 specifies that it's the intentional targeting of civilians that qualifies as a war crime. And so the act that what we call the mens rea, another Latin term, the bad intent really matters here.
As opposed to accidental or incidental. Because yeah, again, we hid in the place that was surrounded by school children, or we were firing from the hospital. Like that, that's just bad mojo right there from.
Although, so when it comes to the proportionality thing, I just want to highlight, proportionality means, though, that you can't, there are many circumstances in which you cannot target the civilian building that you believe may be full of civilians. For example, you know, if you think there is one rebel who just got away from you and ran into that building, you can't shell the building. If you think that there is a unit of highly armed, highly trained, we're starting to get into fuzzy territory. But you know, there are some places, there are some conditions under which we'll be pretty confident that is not proportional.
Yeah, does one dude with a blaster constitute grounds to have an AT or an AT-AT open fire and level a building?
Well, it's like in Rogue One, they have one of the fighters is firing from a terrace, and the Imperial tank just levels the entire terrace down. You know, that's sort of the situation there. The one area that I think Veers probably does get in some amount of trouble is, and I, you know, it depends on how you take this call for a surrender and sort of the actions that followed it. But if he is inviting rebels to surrender, or making some sort of assurance to them that they're going to be treated fairly or, you know, just taken prisoner if they lay down their arms, and then they do that, and then he opens fire on them, that's a form of what's called perfidy, basically. Another word for treachery on the battlefield. We don't want people feigning surrender. We don't want people basically offering terms as a tool of warfare. Interesting. You see a lot of perfidy in Star Wars. A C-3PO commits perfidy in Return of the Jedi when he says they surrender at the Battle of Endor to the stormtroopers, and then all the Ewoks cause all hell to break loose. And then you see it in the Clone Wars. It's like a strangely reoccurring theme.
Well, I mean, we all know the Ewoks are terrible war criminals.
Yeah. Okay. No uniforms.
Very
no
cute. Uniform.
Carnivorous, evil Ewoks feeding upon beaten and stormtroopers who had surrendered. But that's.
Yeah, that's a big one that came up in World War II with the Japanese treatment of American POWs. You should not eat your prisoners of war.
That's not a gray area.
No Chichijima. No.
But it's one thing if he makes that call and then the rebels just flee, right? They don't throw down their arms. They're just doing, you know, Battle of Hoth style. Let's retreat and regroup elsewhere. That's one thing if he were to open fire on a group of rebels like that. But if they come down and they're like, hey, we're going to take you up on your offer, we surrender, and then Veers orders their death, that's a no-no. It would be the technical legal term.
This is you know, not as clear-cut as, say, the Knight of a Thousand Tears. Like, we don't have... It's the pacification of Saline, which just sounds murky. Like there's a lot of it's very murky, like high salinity. that said, it is interesting analysis because most times in Star Wars, it's like, you know, you debate Alderaan. It's like, you can't debate that with a straight face and say like, hey, that was completely justified to blow up an entire planet. Or testing the Death Star on Jeddah. Clean cut. There's no question about it.
I will just
that was a mind disaster.
If there's still shades and degrees here. Jeddah worse than Alderaan. Using a planet to test a weapon, just wanton, right? Like thinking that you might end the entire war because the rebel base is on Alderaan. Still bad, but maybe less bad.
Look, Jeddah was a mining disaster. We all heard the Imperial report. So I don't know why anyone is really questioning that here.
Yeah, no, but so this would be fun in a, you know, potential trial if you also wanted to have some fun with fact witnesses debating the facts, right? So let's say you had a rebel officer who survived and testifies that, in fact, some rebels tried to surrender after Veers called the terms and then were fired upon, which then caused the others to instead flee.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's all kinds of neat ways to handle this. So, which again, so many of these issues in Star Wars, it's clean cut with the Imperials. Like the Imperials are the bad guys, and you can go like, yeah, that's a war crime. Like, done. Like the analysis is 10 seconds of like, you can't do that. You just don't open fire on civilians just cause. Having amazing hair is not a free pass for a war crime like that. No, no, Kylo, no.
Sorry, it's just, yeah. I did not see that. I did not see that in Article 8. Nothing about hairdos.
That's not a valid legal defense. What about high cheekbones like Grand Moff Tarkin's? I think I read that somewhere.
It's just, I mean, it's impressive and striking, but still, no. It's just, you know, like, sure, it's a neat uniform, but that doesn't mean, yeah, we're on board with this. No.
You know, this is not legal related, but it is Veers related. I met back in 2010. I attended my first big convention, but it was Star Wars Celebration 5 down in Orlando. And I got a chance to meet Julian Glover, who plays General Veers. And it was like one of my first like Star Wars autograph, like meetings or whatever. And I was totally geeking out because I'm a huge, huge Veers nerd. And I like gushed him. I said, you know, as a kid, when I saw your character on screen say, you know, yes, Lord Vader, I've reached the main power generator. You may start your landing. I was like, he's not even at the shield generator yet. That's ballsy. And I just loved it. And I, you know, and he told me, he said, you know, I appreciate that. He said, originally, his character was written very, very differently. Veers was very obsequious to Vader. He was like groveling, like, you know, maybe you're more prototypical Imperial officer around Darth Vader. And he said he read it and he kind of asked about his background. You know, he's supposed to be this general and this ground commander. And he's like, he wouldn't be this way. And so he went to George Lucas and said, look, I'm not going to play it the way that it's written here. I'm going to play it as this proud, confident officer, because that's the way it would be in the real world. And Lucas went along with it. And thus the Veers that we have on screen was born. And we can all thank Julian Glover.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, he does have a great resume of films that he was in. And granted, I didn't watch all of Game of Thrones because I have issues with it, but he's in that. And so again, it's just
What is he in Game of Thrones?
He's the one of the king's advisors. I forget his actual title.
Oh, sorry. I just looked at a picture of him. I totally recognize him.
Yeah.
He was also so Donovan in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice and evil.
Yeah.
But not a good picker of chalices, though.
No. And then he referred to the Nazi. So, yeah. But again, let's different. Other than he's a delightful human being and a cinematic treasure, which is why we can talk about a character that has maybe 3 minutes of screen time total, and be able to do an extended podcast about who he is and what this meant.
And I think we're going to get this is Veer's related to commentary, but next month in early November, there's a new book called From a Certain Point of View, Empire Strikes Back coming out. And if you read the one about A New Hope, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. It's basically 20 or so short stories told from different points of view within Empire Strikes Back. So in A New Hope, you got like a story from one of the Jawas. You got a story from a Tusken Raiders point of view. In the Empire Strikes Back book, there is going to be a book or a story, excuse me, from Veer's point of view. So we may have to have part two of this discussion if that sheds some more light.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. Yeah, if there's a section about we lined up the POWs and shot them, well, that would radically change the analysis.
Hey, remember on Saline where we got all those dummies to come out thinking that they could surrender?
I resign as Imperial defense lawyer.
Fish in a barrel.
Waves first. Yeah, it's like, ah, oh, dude.
Come on, Beers. We spent an hour here trying to prop you up, and you give us that.
You wanted to show that there was a professional military side to the Empire. What do you do? You guys write this. Ah! Oh, that would be hysterical. But pivoting to, you know, just being nerdy fans, because, again, we're counting down to Mandalorian Season 2, which should restore joy to all of our lives. Or continue joy, since I've been loving Lower Decks. So again, great time to be a nerd. That said, Thomas, you put together your armor to be Captain Rex, Clone Wars era. And you tell everyone what you did today.
I trooped for the very first time. I got approved officially in the 501st and the Rebel Legion with the armor, because being a clone, you can be dual approved like that. I got approved back in May. This is like a 2+ year project getting this armor sort of done. And it was just in time for there to be no events because everything was canceled.
Oh, no.
And if you're out there and you're unfamiliar with the 501st, other than seeing them in cosplay at conventions, the main bulk of what they do is in the community. Community events, charitable events, they go out and costume up for stuff. So today was my first event. It was a what normally for the last 20 years has been a Down syndrome walk, and the garrison here in Eastern Pennsylvania has been involved in this for a few years now. Normally we walk with the kids. It's like a walk to raise awareness and money for Down syndrome research. This year, because of COVID, they changed it to like a drive-through event. So we were all kind of spread out. There were about 18 of us in costume along a route, and then the kids in their individual fundraising teams got to drive through and say hello. They weren't supposed to get out of the cars, but I loved it that a few of them stopped and like geeked out and got pictures and stuff. So that was my first time in costume for an official 501st event, and it was a lot of fun, very rewarding. And I couldn't see most of the time because my visor just immediately fogged up as soon as I put it on. And so I was sort of like, I was like a T-Rex. My vision was based on movement. So I could see stuff in front of me. If it was moving around, the folks in stormtrooper armor, like the bright white armor, they were visible, but anything else was just sort of like a messy blur, but it was a good time.
Well, this finally explains why the stormtroopers are such bad shots.
That's right. Yeah, I fully get it now. There was somebody out there in our garrison with a really impressive First Order flame trooper costume. And if you're familiar, go back and watch The Force Awakens. It has like the thinnest little visor. And I have a lot of respect. I cannot complain, because he was out there all day with that tiny little visor on. God knows how little he could see, but it looked very impressive.
That's awesome. Yeah. Also, that's just amazing, Tom. That's so cool that you do that.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. So
glad you got to do that. And the bad guys doing good and just trying to bring hope and happiness, you know, while it's still a very stressful world, is a very good thing. So thank you for doing that. Plus your armor is pretty sweet. So
thank you.
Good job building that baby. So with that said, I want to thank everyone for tuning in. I want to thank Thomas and Nari for being able to nerd out together over General Veers and have a nice in-depth discussion about what we know so far. And again, maybe we'll need to revisit this after a certain point of view comes out, because we might have a different point of view after reading that chapter. And so everyone, thank you for tuning in. Stay safe, stay healthy, and we will be back. Take care.